Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, Holly.
Hey, Dave.
Welcome to the What Difference Does It Make podcast.
So excited to be here today.
We've got something unique for this episode. This is a box set that just came out. It celebrates an 80s music scene that we were vaguely familiar with. Tell us a little bit more about this. What is it?
Okay, so the label is called Captured Tracks, and the founder whom we're speaking to, his name is Mike Sniper. But the name of the album is called Strum and Thrum, The American Jangle Underground, 1983 to 1987. And in this scene, there are a bunch of bands that, some that we've heard of, and, you know, REM is at the top, although they're not at this compilation. A bunch of bands that we're going to speak to this episode, the Darrows, the Ferrets, the Bangtails, and the Great Plains.
These bands, they had a thriving local scene that they played in. And we're going to get into that. And kind of, these were bands that kind of took off a little bit and had a little bit of heat and got some airplay on college radio. And so we're going to kind of dig into what it was like at the time, where they are now, kind of learn all about what this Strum and Thrum scene is. And we don't even know if Strum and Thrum is the correct term.
But turns out we like the music without even knowing what it was called at the time.
Yeah, well, we love 80s music, and we love that sound. This was something unique. It definitely was a college radio sound that we played. There were little pockets all over the country, and this album, this box set, Strum and Thrum, kind of celebrates this type of music. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, so let's get into it. Here's Mike Sniper from Captured Tracks.
Every band we've talked to has been so, they received their package of Strum and Thrum, and they've just been over the moon on the look. They love the vinyl. They love the booklet is just has a lot of stuff in there. It's just a fun coffee table read, I guess.
For me, it's like one of the cool things about these reissues is that, right? It is, one of the reasons why people buy these things is for seeing all that ephemera and kind of getting into that world, which is why I kept on hassling everyone. Like, please send us more stuff. Like, we want more photos, more old merch you might have had.
There's a lot of stuff in there.
Well, we're basically creating an entire context for something, right? Mm-hmm. So if this was... like, I love 60s garage comps. I love 60s Northern Soul comps. I love all those, but the context already exists, right? You don't really have to. It's almost like I have to explain why this comp exists, as opposed to, there's a market already here. Let's cater to it. And I'm not saying anything wrong with that. That's cool because I'm that market too. So, if you have something that's like a rare 70s punk, like Killed by Death style punk compilation, you don't really need to provide any reason as to what is this? Why am I buying this? It's like, if you like that kind of music, you're going to want to buy it. So for me, I was thinking on both on two sides. One was the collector market of people my age and younger, and slightly older, of people who collect the equivalent of this kind of music, but not American music, right? And then I was also thinking of a younger audience who are fans with some of the bands on our label. So I was trying to like cater to both of those two markets. Sometimes they interact, but there's lots of, let's be honest, record snobs that don't pay attention to any new music, right? There are people going to buy this comp with no idea who Dive and Beach Fossils are, and that's fine. And there are people on this, who buy this comp who know who Dive and Beach Fossils are and have never heard a Flying Nun record in their life, and that's fine too. So that's kind of like where... So I wanted this compilation to be in my collection. I wanted it to have a big book. and I wanted it to have stories in it. And I wanted it to have as much ephemera in it as possible, look really nice. Like, it was a completely and utterly, you know, it was almost like I was creating a gift for myself, you know?
Sure,
and,
I get that.
Hopefully other people like it. You know, that's how I see this entire series going of excavations of this is like part one of it. But, you know, it's not always going to be this kind of music. It's not always going to be 80s music. It's not always going to be guitar-based music. But I figured for the first one, this is the most appropriate.
That was Patron of the Arts by The Bang Tales. And now we speak with Mark White and Michael Sump from the band.
Sumpy, buddy.
Hey, what's up, man?
How long has it been since you guys have seen each other?
We haven't seen each other for a long time.
No, I mean, I saw Archer back in the maybe 1989 or 1990 when I was in Massachusetts. But I haven't seen you since Kansas City, Mike.
Yeah.
Wow.
Not a long time.
Yeah, really long time. Good to see you, buddy. How long have you been up in New York, Mike?
It's just almost 20 years now.
Wow. Yeah, I'm in Columbus for about 20 now, Columbus, Ohio.
So you guys both grew up in Kansas City.
I grew up in just outside in Lawrence, Kansas, which is practically a suburb, really.
Yeah. It's
the Jayhawks. That's where the university is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing about when I met Mike and Archer, for that matter, although I knew Archer first because we went to school together. But I'd been hanging out, going to these all-age shows that were just like hardcore and, you know, pretty basic stuff. And it wasn't, you know, the music was, you know, it was okay, but it was more of a scene than anything because I was more interested. I was, you know, had listened to The Clash and The Jam and, you know, more tuneful, accomplished players. And when I met Mike, you know, he really got my attention because he actually knew how to play guitar. He didn't just buy a guitar and learn three chords. He actually knew how to play guitar. And that was actually a pretty rare phenomenon at the time.
That's how it started. And we played our first practice in Mark's apartment.
Yeah, that was a great practice space, man.
Yeah, in an apartment? What was this apartment like?
Yeah.
Well,
it was actually great.
It was a big old house that, like typical in student housing, it had been broken up into like four or five apartments. And Scott Rabko and I were roommates there. You know, we moved in and we paid our rent, you know, for a number of months. And eventually the guy stopped coming around for the rent and we never saw him again. So we never paid rent again. We just stayed in that house. It was a legitimate squat.
Yeah,
and I squatted there then too later.
Yeah, you later on moved in. In fact, you know, the band was always like all, or the house was always all musicians, and there were like three practice spaces in the basement.
This was
the only way actually I was able to afford I bought a new drum kit, one drum at a time. It was because I wasn't paying rent, so I had this extra, you know, spending money. And, you know, eventually the bank came around and they kicked us all out of the house. And that was kind of, I think, right around the time the band ended. There's no connection between the two events. But I kind of feel like after that practice, we didn't have a practice space after that.
I looked on YouTube for Patron of the Arts and there's a guy, Jeff Johnson. Does that name ring a bell?
Yeah, he was the engineer.
Okay, because he posted a comment, said, talking about Patron of the Arts, that he said, I sort of had to convince the band that the almost completely broken quality of the vocals was not to be fixed or messed with. Plus, the band was pretty much out of money after 4 hours at $15 an hour. So, does that sound about right?
That sounds right.
Yeah, that was $60. We scraped by. I know what you're talking about. Jeff Johnson. He recorded Patron of the Arts in his studio. That's the guy.
Yeah.
Well, $15 an hour. That's a long time ago.
That's a good, yeah.
How poor were we that was all we had to spend $60 for this thing?
Yeah.
God.
Yeah, well, he was actually cool. He wanted to do it, so, you know.
Yeah.
Were you aware of this term strum and thrum, and would you use that to describe your music, or was it, how would you describe the band? Because I'm sure that's what everyone always asks the band. How would you describe your sound?
Well, I described it as melodic stomping and screaming or whatever. I can't remember the actual quote. So it's close.
I've heard jangly applied to Patron of the Arts especially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's not any live. There's like one song, I think, on that Live from Lawrence LP compilation that is a live recording of us. The record that we have, that Patron of the Arts song, it's actually a lot poppier than most of what we played. You know, Mike's guitar feedback and the kind of like heavy sounds he would get out of this. What was that Gibson guitar of yours, man? That was like falling apart.
Yeah, I still got it.
It was this really deep hollow body, and that thing would just howl. There was like, Mike would play the feedback, you know, as part of the song. Mm-hmm. And so that doesn't sound to me like it's strum and thrum or jangle.
We are more of a live band than, I mean, our live show, I always thought we couldn't really figure out how to.
Way out there. There was a lot of jamming, a lot of jammy stuff. Songs would go on and they'd sort of rise and fall. And
Yeah. It seemed like every time we played new songs, all new songs.
Yeah, yeah. I will say, did you get your copy of the record, Mike?
No, I'm going to go buy the orange.
It's gorgeous. It's gorgeous.
Yeah,
I got it a couple days ago.
You want to describe it?
You got it?
Yeah, I got it. Yeah. I got the vinyl, the orange vinyl. And you're going to love
it. Orange vinyl?
That's what they sent me. That's probably what you'll get.
Well, I was going to go buy one. I'm actually going to go buy one anyway.
Oh, you?
No, it's
you need to make a phone call.
Gorgeous. It's a really great looking package. I mean, it's
a great package, but it's also great. The sound, I've listened to all the tracks before, and there's not a clinker in any of them. And I'm a music snob, so.
Yeah, it's a pretty lively bunch of bands, I have to say. You know, a lot of these bands, I have to tell you, they were a lot more accomplished than we were when I was reading them. They all had like connections and toured with, bands that you'd heard of and were there in the early days. And, you know, we were like on the tail end of the era that is covered. And we only had that, you know, one 12-inch record we put out. And we didn't really tour. We were sort of confined to I-70 between Lawrence, Kansas and St. Louis. And I don't even know if we got to St. Louis more than once or twice.
Well, we used to play the Grand Emporium all the time. I love that place.
That was our home base.
Is this Kansas City? Is that, what was that club like?
That was a blues club, but it became this alternative music place. We were one of the first ones to do their alternative.
Yeah, we would be at the Emporium on Monday night, no matter who was on the bill. Because that was the definition of a scene. You know, the bands were going to be cool, even if you didn't know who they were. And all your friends were going to be there. You knew the bartender. The doorman would always let you in because you were like a regular. They had 50-cent draws and, you know, 50 cents for a beer. I mean, that was what we lived on. The other place we played a lot was the Blue Note in Columbia, Missouri.
Yeah.
Yeah, we shuffled between, I mean, our home base was the Emporium in Kansas City, but we could get over to Columbia, Missouri, which is the campus. You know, it's like Austin, Texas. It's in the middle of this horrible red state, but it's just one cool town. And we were called not infrequently to open for touring acts there. We opened for John Hyatt there.
Just listening
to
the
way to spend your early 20s, though.
For sure.
You had like your gang, you know. And your uniform, you had your leather jacket, you know, your boots. Mike had this pair of black cowboy boots that they had the duct tape to hold them together, you know.
I got four of those now.
He had the leather pants, too. You remember you got those leather jeans?
Yeah, I lost those.
Well, you know, they still make them, Mike. Just rock dudes making the scene. I was working in a record store. It couldn't have been a bigger cliche.
Yeah. Let's go back to Mike Sniper from the label Captured Tracks. So what was your A&R like? What did you remember all these bands, or what was the research like? Did you have to go through your college radio playlists of back in the day?
I didn't go to college till 1995.
So. Oh, is that, oh, okay.
College radio was already on its way out, so, and like none of these bands were being played on it, that's for sure.
They were all gone by then, yeah.
I did grow up in the Jersey Shore, and there was 106.3, which Matt Pinfield hosted. I'm sure WFMU played the hell out of like Absolute Gray and all those bands. What I was doing was basically going through my records that I bought because they were completely overlooked, right? So I would see a cover of a sleeve, like 1+2, that sleeve. I'm like, this looks like something I like. And I'd play it, and I'd be like, this song's good. Nobody cares about this. Okay. You know, and eventually, but this goes back to when I was working at like Midnight Records and Academy Records and the Princeton Record Exchange. I was just a guy that worked in a record store. And I didn't think like, I have enough here for a compilation. I had a friend over. It was actually Mike who was the original drummer in Widow's Peak and Easy TV, and he and his wife Pam, who worked at the label, they were over, and I think I played the Reverbs and maybe one of the other records on this comp. I forget which one, and that's when I started thinking like this would be a cool comp. But if I told anyone I was making this comp, in terms of the people on my side, they would think I'm completely crazy because the timing of it and what it represents and the fact that you have to create the market for it. I don't see why. I mean, if you listen to it and think about people like this kind of stuff that don't know these bands, I mean, I didn't think it was that hard, but a lot of other people are like, you're out of your mind. Because I would tell them like the bands on it, and like, I've skipped over that record in the dollar bin for like 20 years, you know? Everybody said she had a cool one.
That was She Was Unkind by the band The Ferrets.
Here's James Huey of The Ferrets.
So what brings you to Portland? What do you got going on over there?
Well, I originally came out just to get a change from Rochester and came out about back in 1996 and ended up, I was going to leave music. I'd been doing recording engineering, then the studio kind of was locked out with other, like a big project and stuff. And I thought, oh, I'll get out of music, get into computers. Well, first thing that happened was I came out here and joined a band immediately. And then ended up actually doing a lot of musical stuff with some of my heroes who were on the West Coast. So,
and so. What kind?
Yeah, come on, Jim. Spill it out. Oh, we need to.
sorry, I haven't talked to anybody in a while.
We're the same way. This is the
COVID
only
isolation thing. So, well, after I was working for a while, I saved up enough money, wanted to produce my own album, My Songs. And so I got in touch with Russ Tolman, who was in True West and also produced 28th Day on this CD. And, years ago when I was in the few bands back in Rochester, like the Invisible Party and the Ferrets, we'd opened up for True West, got to know them a little bit. So, and then Russ brought him up here. We worked on my recording and then I played on some of his and then ended up helping getting True West back together. And at that point they needed a rhythm section. And had this bass player friend of mine, and we got to play with him for a number of shows, and that was great.
Let's head back to Rochester, where it all began. Is that where you grew up? Are you from there?
Yeah, I was from the suburbs of Rochester.
That's upstate New York. Like, how far away from from Buffalo? Are you close to Buffalo? Or you?
Yeah, you know, people down in New York City I used to talk to when I was working at a record store, they'd say, where is that? That's not upstate. And when I tell them, they're like, that's Canada, you know? So, yeah, it's about 60 miles from Buffalo. And it was the home of Kodak, so that's
kind of made it famous.
And Chuck Mangione and Lou Gramm from Foreigner.
Hey!
And the Chesterfield Kings.
So look at that.
I did meet the Chesterfield Kings. In fact, the Rickenbacker, my friend Chaz played on the Ferret song on the compilation we bought from Andy from the Chesterfield Kings. So
That's true. We didn't even... Yeah, we didn't touch on that about the Rickenbacker. It's kind of like the instrument of the strum and thrum. That's the instrument of choice. Everyone's got to have their own Rickenbacker. Tell me your Rickenbacker story.
Well, we bought that from Andy. It had been played by Ori, who was in the Chesterfield Kings, and got a great deal on it. It had the big Chesterfield Kings logo on it. I loved the sound of the Rickenbacker, like, you know, through the Birds and the Beatles stuff, and then through Bobby Sutliff and the Windbreakers, and then REM's Reckoning album. I just love that album so much. So we got it, and then we were using it in the studio, but we found, like, there wasn't a tuner back then. We didn't have a tuner. Those were so hard to tune. In fact, I was just listening to the track from the CD because I just received it. And I was like, it's still a little out of tune. I could hear that. But, oh well, there it is.
Okay, we're right in the middle of our talk with artists associated with the album Strum and Thrum. We'll be right back.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the What Difference Does It Make podcast. Here's Mike Sniper of Captured Tracks.
Tracking these guys down, you must have been almost like Indiana Jones trying to like, oh, I have this. Now I have to find where these people are located. And I'm sure a lot of them were out of the business. And, you know, so what was that?
Some of them I didn't. Some of them I never.
You never found them.
I just assumed this LinkedIn or Facebook or Twitter profile was them. Because what you do, you look at the name. And then you find the artist, you find the band name. Okay, what's the most unique name in this band? And then you like Google that name in the area that the band is from, the general area. And like 9 times out of 10, they'd still have be involved in maybe not music, but art in some regard. You're like, oh, I bet you that's it. Or you go to their Facebook and it's all anti-Trump. It's like that, this is the crazy person. If you go to the Facebook and it's like, you know, some hunter with a MAGA hat, you're like, I don't think that this is the guy from that band.
Powers of deduction.
That was the Great Plains. When do you say hello?
Here's Mark Wyatt of Great Plains.
Beaumont, Texas, Hurricane Alley.
Yeah. Oh, geez.
How'd you end up in Beaumont, Texas?
Well, my wife is an academic dean, and this is where she got a job as Dean of Arts and Sciences at Lamar University. And I work from home, so I can pretty much follow her anywhere. I basically still have the same job as I did even before Great Plains started. That tells you how long I've been working with the American Chemical Society. So,
can we go to Columbus for a second? I mean, is that where you grew up?
Born there almost all my life. Yeah.
And so, what was the music scene like back in Columbus when you were?
You know, when we started, it was mostly bar bands, you know, doing country stuff and, you know, hard rock stuff. And punk really, we got pretty much relegated to, you know, what I always call new wave nights, which was like the night that was like the least populated in a bar. So they would give you that night, like Tuesday night or something like that. Mm-hmm. But once we got going, I mean, there were good bands before us, but we kind of kickstarted to some extent kind of a mini scene. It was like us and Scrawl and the Gibson Brothers, the Royal Crescent Mob, you know, there were, you know, and everybody eventually put out records, and Gibson Brothers were on Homestead just like us. And well, I'll give you a quick story of how we got on Homestead. So somehow our bass player at the time, Don Howland, he had just moved to Hoboken, but he was going to join us for a show that he actually got us into a show that Ira Kaplan from Yellow Tango was one of the people who booked it. It was called Music for Dozens, and it was at Folk City in Manhattan.
Gertie's.
You know, yeah, where Dylan started.
Right.
You know? It's not there anymore. We opened up for The Plugs, which I think had already, they changed their name to the Cruzados at that point, but we opened up for them. We had what I thought was a fairly ramshackle show, but I guess it was exciting enough that the guy who actually started Homestead, Sam Berger, was working at Dutch East India Trading. He came up to me afterwards and said, "You guys were godlike." And I'm, you know, he gives me his card, you know, and already I was kind of like jaded. I'm like, yeah, who is this? You know, who is this bum? He's probably had a few drinks in him, you know? And so Ron looks at it, and he's a record store guy. He worked at record stores all his life, and said like, "No, Dutch East India is a real company." And so Dutch East distributed our first EP. And then Sam kind of got Homestead going, and we were one of the first people he signed up. So Homestead really wasn't anything when we started. It got to be more than it was, but especially once they started snagging people like Sonic Youth and Dinosaur and, you know, stuff like that. Sure. I mean, you know, go to New York, get discovered, you know, woo, what a cliche.
I don't know. It's kind of a dream.
It was cool. It was very, I mean, we were kind of big shots for a minute in Columbus once we got that deal with a New York label, you know.
Were you riding that wave for a while? What was that like as, you know, like
people came out in Columbus? Yeah. I mean, you know, it's nice to have, you know, we self-financed our first record, and, you know, it was nice to have somebody else like, you know, pony up the cash and had the distribution to get it out there. So we didn't tour as hard as some of the Homestead acts. We were mostly weekend warriors for quite some time. But luckily from Columbus, you can be a weekend warrior and still play like Chicago, New York, like just half the country's right within a weekend, you know.
And what was the college radio scene like? I'm sure in Columbus it was great for you.
Yeah.
College radio was, you know, one of the strange things about Columbus is like it's got one of the biggest universities in the country with Ohio State, but virtually no support for our scene, certainly from any of the students. It was mostly like the art schools and punks and stuff that would come out to our kind of shows. And the college station in Columbus was a student run, you know, station at Ohio State, which was pretty cool. But I mean, Cleveland has an amazing array of, and still does, of college radio. They have practically a network up there, but we didn't have that. And certainly the big, you know, the QFM 96s and stuff wouldn't touch us for a very, very long time. And when they did, they played a import EP that was supposed to be played at 45 RPM. They played it at 33.
Oh, God.
I still have a tape of it somewhere.
Yeah, that's it's like, awesome.
It was hilarious.
So this song, this is called When Do You Say Hello?
Yeah.
How did this end up being the song for the album?
This thing just dropped out of the sky. I mean, we just got... You know, we got this email from Captured Tracks saying like, hey, we're going to put out this compilation and we'd like to use this song. They chose it. I guess I was still the grumpy old jaded dude. And I was going like, who's Captured Tracks? And once again, Ron jumped in and said like, no, they're a great label. And I started looking at their website and going like, oh, yeah, they are great. Okay. And they've been amazing through this whole process. It's been extended, of course, because of the pandemic and everything. And we were even supposed to go to New York to help them with an album release, but that ain't happening. So we've done a few reunions over the years, so we can knock the rust off fairly quickly. But
were you aware of these words strum and thrum and that you might be lumped into that?
No. I mean, you know, I think... You know, it's funny. I just got my band copy of it yesterday, and almost all the bands they quote say, we didn't think we were jangle rock. We certainly didn't.
Right.
We called ourselves folk punk when people like cornered us into calling, you know, describing us as anything.
I like that.
Had folky chords, but it was done punkier. I mean, I don't know. I brought a lot of garage to it because that's my thing. I'm a caveman, you know, garage organist, knocking rocks together.
Is that how you grew up on like 60s garage rock or what?
I'm total nuggets dude. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
They sent the bands the limited edition orange vinyl. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're really great. I mean, it's the book is massive. I mean, like I'm just picking up the box when it came yesterday. It was huge. But yeah, it is really neat. A lot of my friends are on it. Good pals with the Tim and Bobby from the Windbreakers. I even played on the two later Windbreakers records. Most of the Homestead band slept on my floor, like Salem 66 and, you know, Windbreakers and all that. You know, I was the hotel in Columbus for any of the Homestead acts. So.
Apparently you were the one with the only steady job.
Yeah. I was kind of an anomaly because I had a great job with the ACS when Great Plains started and I had a fair amount of vacation time. So I never had to take a split of any band money. You know, I always had, you know, beer and food for the bands that came in and everything because I had a job, you know, a real job. So
you were like the father figure.
Well, we were older than a lot of them. That's true. We were the old guys on the scene. Yeah. Just a quick funny. For some reason, maybe about 10 years ago, Jay Maskus from Dinosaur Jr. Was in Columbus and he comes up to me and you know, he always talks slow and he goes, hey, Mark, you still have that job? I go, yeah, Jay, I still have that job.
Oh, he's a national treasure. Oh, I love him so.
No, they were great. They stayed, you know, Murph and, you know, the guys, they all stayed on my floor. You know, God, those guys were loud. Jeez.
Even without the instruments, they were loud? Really? Or are you talking about the...
No. I'm just saying their shows. We played with them in Boston. It was like Salem 66, us, and then Dinosaur. They were just getting started. And it was so freaking loud that they just pasted me against the back wall of the club. So it was,
yeah, they It's still that same volume. Sure, yeah, I don't know. That hasn't age hasn't slowed them down at all. They're still cranking it up. It's great.
No.
God.
We actually got asked to do a thing in Columbus about 3-4 years ago called Sick Weekend. And we headlined on co-headlined on Saturday night with the Zero Boys, who we you know, Paul Mahern from the Zero Boys produced our last LP, Something's Up. So we've known him forever, and it was really fun. And it was a younger crowd too, which I really liked. You know, it's like, oh wow, we haven't been totally forgotten. Okay, great.
Or maybe it's the parents taking their kids.
It could be.
As we do.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Actually, Paul Mahern like got on stage and said, you should have seen how we partied with your mom back in the day.
Oh. Ooh. Let's go back to Mike Sniper. Track order, a new personality you put as the last track. Yeah. And how do you figure the track order? I mean, why the reverb's number one? I mean, I think Salem 66 might have been the only band I'd heard of. They're kind of in the middle. Yeah. You got the Windbreakers, number four. So anyway, what is your strategy with track order?
It is science.
Yeah, I know. Of course. Please explain your science.
So, I mean, the thing is that it is like a batting order, right? So, like the Windbreakers are the cleanup hitter, right? So, right. Reverbs, the first 20 seconds, you know what this comp is all about. The whole kind of idea behind it is basically laid out in the music immediately, like, I know what this is, you know. And then you gotta come, the second and third tracks also have to be upbeat, and then the Windbreakers is like mid-tempo, and that's meant to kind of, any artist who's making this kind of music should do it that way. Do not open with a slow song unless it's your fourth record, right?
It's like going to a live show, you know, what you expect.
Yeah. And I mean, that's why I was thinking two ways, like streaming and side to side, like a record collector or like somebody buys the vinyl versus like, let's say a reviewer who's going to just stream the whole thing to review it, or like 20 seconds of each song. And it's like, that's a lot of jangle, you know,
right, right.
That's a lot of strum and thrum. So, it, you know, you kind of try to diversify within, I mean, it's not a diverse comp. It's not supposed to be. How do we, let's get a moody song here. Let's get a song that's a little bit more folk rocky here. Let's get one that's a little more British influenced here, right? So yeah, like a new personality is very British influence, and it closes it, and the reverbs is like completely American sounding to me. That was on purpose. Plus a new personality is almost like that song is like end credits of a John Hughes movie or something. You know? Like, oh, they got together.
Is that how you explained it to a new personality? Instead of like, oh man, you have us last? What? Come on.
End credits.
Come on. Let's.
I knew Brian would get it because he's ahead, you know, and he knows like the way, you know, I wasn't worried about that.
Okay.
The idea is that to keep reinvest, like re-get everyone's grasp, have them come back to be excited about it as it goes. And that's why it's hopefully if this worked out. I mean, on Spotify, it's supposed to be two different playlists when it comes out, because I don't ask anyone to sit there and listen to these 38 songs. Right. So it's designed almost as like two volumes in one. Mm. And so, I mean, track one, side one of LP two, which would be Spotify part two, track one, I believe is the Riff Doctors. It's the same concept, you know, mm-hmm. It's like you're doing the same thing the first time. So that's how I saw it digitally. I saw it. I was thinking about turning it over four times. If you buy it on vinyl, I was thinking about reviewers. And then I was also thinking about Spotify listeners and not asking them to do all of them. Listen to part one on Spotify, then listen to Al Green or whatever. And then come back whenever you feel like it for part two is kind of the concept.
That was Is It You by the Darrows.
Here's Derek Chafin of the Darrows.
I graduated from Villanova University and started my band right out of college. It was the first kind of real band I'd been in, like, you know, a couple cover bands. Yeah, so we started up in 85 and set sail. I really, really want to try my hand at music. You know, I just want to do that for a while. And a while turned out forever. So
So what was the Philly scene like at that time?
Oh my God, did we complain? We complained and we wouldn't stop complaining. But it was amazing compared to what, you know, bands have to go through today. Man, it was really the golden years. There were tons of places to play. There was an enthusiastic audience that really meant something. They were, you know, all the bands meant something to them. They were, you know, it was more than just, let's go out and, you know, just have a good time at a bar. It was like, there was a feeling of wanting to be a part of that community and what we're trying to do, you know, being alternative and kind of carving our own path. Everybody felt the similar vibe. So the crowds were amazing. It wasn't hard to pack rooms back then, you know?
Oh, that's great. Did you have were you a house band at any certain club?
J.C. Dobbs, definitely our home. It was back in the day. I mean, it was the first place to host Pearl Jam. I saw Nirvana there. I think their legal limit was 150 people. But Kathy James was the proprietor of the place. She was also our booking agent, it turned out. CBGB's and J.C. Dobbs are kind of like the same kind of entity. Kathy's skill was she really promoted bands she believed in and didn't think about, you know, what their draw was immediately. So the Darrows, you know, we went in and the first couple times, I just thought we were horrible. And didn't really feel good about the crowd and all that kind of stuff. But Kathy believed in us and she kept on putting us in. And pretty soon, you know, we were headlining on the weekend. So it was great. And also opening it for other bands. So you could open up for nationals. So I think we opened up for Trip Shakespeare there, okay. All kinds of other bands, which is not really accessible to bands now. You know, you don't open up for a living, you know, we opened up for Living Color. It was like, that just never happens. It was a great scene back then. And the crowd, the clubs, the choices, and also the camaraderie.
Yeah.
It was a healthy competitive atmosphere. Like I would see a band that I really dug and it would inspire me to write a better song. I didn't feel like, oh, you know, I don't want to hear them again. You know, I was like, wow, man, I got to do better.
Yeah. You know,
it was great.
It makes me feel old saying this, but it felt like a much more organic process back then. You know,
there was nobody else but us. You know, there wasn't really, we didn't feel like there were really record labels yet. That started to happen. In the beginning, it wasn't like that at all. We just wanted to kind of do our thing and make our, you know, be a part of that conversation that was going on. That was it, you know?
Yeah, after, I guess, the Hooters were like the band that kind of exploded. Was that, did you see like after they came, as after they broke that there were more more industry people in the audience at that time?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, Philly became, you know, super hot there for a while. It seemed mattered. You could tell, and it was more of the question of who's next. That kind of feeling was around. We knew the clubs were packed all the time. We knew that people were really into it, and we knew that we had something going on here. But the music was very, very diverse. You know, the Hooters were you know, kind of a reggae band in Philadelphia. That's how they kind of started. And then there were other bands that were more kind of dramatic, that were almost like a theater show. And then there was, you know, the alternative scene, the college scene. Rarely did those two things kind of go together, those kinds of bands. Some were just straight up blues bands, all that kind of stuff. So when we got to play those clubs, we were, you know, extra incentivized to do well. And, you know, it was great. I mean, we played a room called the Chestnut Streets Cabaret, and it was, I think, 800 person capacities. And we opened up for the Pogues there. And it was like,
that's been insane.
You bring game, you know?
Philadelphia, yeah. The Pogues in Philly, I could imagine that's.
Oh my God, was that a fun show? Oh my Lord. I came off stage and I literally danced from the front of the stage to the bar to get a drink and back. I didn't ask for it. It was if people started just like swinging each other around. So I tried to move that way, you know, and then move back that way.
Oh man.
It was great.
Oh
yeah.
That's a good scene.
You should have seen the stacks of beer backstage. Oh my God, I've never seen so much beer.
Did you get close to Shane? Did you could you understand what he was saying or that's what I want. That's what I want from Shane. Oh man.
The band was great and friendly, and it was almost to a person. Every time we would come across a band in that environment, they were super kind. you know, let me color, let us use the drum kit. Like, you know, what headliner lets you use the drum kit? Great. Just great experiences. Never ran into a problem.
So you did manage to, you put out a record, one record, one EP, which is actually, I looked up, we could download it for free on Bandcamp. Which
Can you?
Yeah. You can. They're both. Yeah, both of those. Both the album.
Cool. I mean, Mark Schreiber has been curating the drummer, and he's been kind of curating.
Oh, is that? Okay. Catalog. Yeah, wonderful. Because actually, I did see that you've also regrouped. You played together.
After 30 years, right? I got to tell you, that was wonderful. That was it was amazing how quickly it came back. It was shocking. I was like, man, we rehearsed and played and played and played. And if you just kind of took your mind out of it, your fingers just did the trick. You know, it was like, everybody knew where we were pretty quickly after when we started, because we were all, you know, like, oh my God, this is going to suck. We got to really work. You know, we don't want to be, I don't want to have a bad memory of the band. This is about remembering how, you know, yeah, it was great. It ended up being super fun, really connecting between all of us. I mean, what a long, strange trip it's been, you know, and that stuff, and also just playing the music again and having the perspective now of a guy in my 50s of a guy looking back on our 20s and playing that music. The funny thing was, we were much more aggressive now. We were like, oh my, I think we got to tone this down. You know, it's like,
got a lot of anger after 30 years.
Yeah, I expect to be a little weaker. It was a lot stronger. We had to
That's great.
Off.
Oh, that's nice. Good to know.
That's funny. As you say, you have more confidence as you get older and you've been playing for so many more years, except that back then, maybe you have some blind confidence.
Yes.
All right. Yeah. So speaking of blind confidence, can we talk about this video you made for Is It You?
Yeah.
I watched it last night, and it's obviously done on the cheap. I'm sure it was friends of yours in Philadelphia, walking through Philadelphia.
Yeah. Yeah, there was I'm remiss to remember. I should remember his name. I don't. He worked for a local public access cable thing. It was called Adelphia Cable. I don't know if it was associated with a larger company later, became Adelphia. But he was bored out of his mind and wanted to do something. And he had all this gear and all this machinery. And I was like, hey man. He's like, can we do a video? And we did like the local public broadcast, you know, three of us went for an interview and, you know, three people are watching online, you know. So I was like, sure, let's do a video. And I feel like I roped him into something because I'm like, yeah, let's use 8mm film and we'll transfer that. And this is, and he was so good. He was so kind, you know, to do it. And all the time he shot, you know, shooting it and all that stuff. It was crazy.
You got to be happy to be able to see it now.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I definitely remember, like, you know, talking to my friend, like, hey, can we use your barn to shoot this one sequence in? My girlfriend at the time is in the video twirling around.
That's okay. I was going to ask who that twirling vixen was. Who's
It was Julie Cowitz. We're still friends, but she's great. Everybody got involved.
It had a very college feel to it. Like, like, here we are, three goofy guys just dancing around downtown Philly.
That was it. That was exactly it. And it was, you know, it was a fun band. These guys were smart. They were funny. And there was just a feeling of, you know, get out there and do it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, make some video, man. Do something interesting. Everybody did their job, you know?
Right, right.
Going through this whole experience and being part of this compilation, it really made me think about kind of your essence as a writer. And you know, I've gone on to do all kinds of stuff. I've written string quartets, and I've, you know, produced hardcore metal to classical records. And but there is nothing about, like, looking back at your first records and seeing the unbridled you. You know, like, you don't have any language yet. You don't know how to do it. You just do it. Whatever comes out is just rah. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the stuff deep down inside you. And man, is that an important lesson to never lose touch with. Like, no matter what I do or where I go, I'm always going to have a bit of Darrow's in it, you know, because that's how it manifests. That's the first time I really, you know, got to hear that about what I really kind of am, you know. It's been cool recognizing some of that and listening to the music and going back and kind of, you know, wow, man, things don't really change, you know, the way I kind of do a chorus or whatever. It's, you know, it's just something there that, you know.
Yeah, it's what you heard as a kid. That's it always comes out, I think.
It's and also to not lose touch of the rawness, I think, as a writer, you know, to the more you learn, sometimes the less instinct you have in it. And there's something magical about not editing that, about just putting it out. Remember what it's like, that childlike quality, you know, of playing, of getting lost in it, of not knowing exactly what you're doing makes original creative music. Mm-hmm. So I'm constantly telling people to not overthink it, you know, and myself included now.
And let's give the last word to Mike Sniper.
I mean, a lot of people who know me personally and know what a record nerd I am, they're like, why haven't you made a compilation? It's just like, it's got to be the right. I didn't want to make another of one someone else already made. You know, I wanted something. I'm not saying that this is a completely unique compilation. Don't get me wrong. I mean, there is some crossover with things like Teen Line that came out, which was mostly power pop, but did have some of this kind of stuff that Chuck Warner put out. There's precedent for sure. You know, I just wanted to make sure that it was, you know, Ricky Henderson's starting in line. Your first batter's got to get on base, you know, and he's got to get home.
This was so great. This was really fun. I really enjoyed talking to all the artists that appear on the Strum and Thrum compilation.
Yeah, it was great. I feel like it was a reunion for a lot of these bands, and kind of cool that some of these guys who hadn't talked to each other or were not actually familiar with each other are now kind of know what this scene was like. They kind of learned about that their music, while it seemed unique in their little pocket of whatever city they were playing in, there was actually another band that was playing music that was similar in style.
Thanks to Mike Sniper of Captured Tracks, Derek Chafin of the Darrows, James Huey of the Ferrets, Mark Wyatt of Great Plains, and Mark White and Michael Sump of the Bangtails.
Yeah, and we'd also like to thank additional members at Captured Tracks. That would be Natalie Miano, Mike Brinkworth, Adam Gerard, and Chris Pappas. Thank you so much for helping us out in putting this episode together.
This was so great. This was a really fun episode, and I loved hearing some of the music that I recognized and didn't recognize.
Yeah, so the album is out now, so go find it. Go to your independent record store and pick one up.
If you're in Brooklyn, you can go to the Captured Tracks store and pick it up there.
Such a good idea.
Thanks for listening to the What Difference Does It Make podcast, proud member of the Pantheon podcast family.
Very good. So until next week, this is Dave.
This is Holly.
Check you later.
Over and out.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Frunino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.